All right, we're good to go. So welcome everyone, this is 6110. For how many of you is this your first term here? Probably, okay, so almost all of you. All right, well, welcome to Concordia. I hope that you have a very good master's or PhD, depending on what position you're in. So my name's Jeremy. You can call me Professor Clark if it makes you uncomfortable, but just call me Jeremy, it's fine. I have office hours. They'll be today, so they're earlier, on Mondays from 3 to 5. They'll be in my office, which is in the EV building, ninth floor. And they're drop-in office hours, so if you're coming to office hours, you don't have to email me ahead of time to say that you're coming or to set up an appointment. You can just show up, and that's fine. And if you do show up... If you can't show up during that time for whatever reason, then you can send me an email. We can set up a time outside of those office hours. You can also ask me questions during class, either during the break, which will be in the middle of class, or at the end of class. I'll stick around and answer questions. We'll have a marker for the course, Nan, and he'll just mark the assignments. Usually I mark the exams. He might help mark the exams. We'll see this year. The course line is available. Let's see. So there's no textbook for this course. The course will be based solely on the lecture notes themselves. You won't be tested outside of it. That said, if there's some concept that maybe you don't quite get in class, you're a little confused about it, textbook might help you sort of fill it out, or you know, it might describe it in a slightly different way that I do. So it might be useful to look at a textbook anyways. So the two textbooks, actually I have three here. All three of them are available for free as PDFs. You can also get a paper copy if you really want from Amazon or something like that. And then I try and give some pointers to where the stuff is in the textbooks as we go through. The lectures aren't necessarily strictly based off the textbooks themselves, so the notation might be different, or they might define things slightly differently. So in case of any disagreement, the lecture notes is what I want you to know, but these things will just sort of help fill out the picture if you need it. Okay, if the lecture notes are fine, then that's fine as well. Okay, all right, I'll come back to this. Another thing I'll mention is that I record all of the lectures. So if you have a question and it's going to be on the recording, it will be posted on the internet. If you'd rather not have your question online for anyone to hear, you can just tell me ahead of time before you ask the question. I can pause it, or after class and I can edit it out of the transcript. Otherwise, if I don't hear from you, I'm going to assume that I have your permission to post it online. The lecture notes I typically will write into a tablet. So I used to write it on the blackboard. Students didn't really like it because you have to come to class, you have to take notes. Now I write into a tablet, so you'll have a copy of the notes and you'll have the audio. And so if you miss a class, it probably isn't that consequential. You can probably make do with those two things. Today I'm missing my tablet. I'll have it for next class. So I'm going to just use last year's lecture notes for lecture one. So I won't be writing it out in real time. We'll just use it. So this class will be slightly different. But going forward, starting at next week, we'll do the notes sort of live as we go through them. Okay. Assignments and exams. So there'll be two assignments. The first will be in October, early October. The second will be in late November. There'll be a midterm. The midterm you'll write in class. It's on October 23rd. So there'll be no class, but there will be a midterm. And then you'll have a final project and a final exam. The final project is posted. You can take a look at it. I'll circle back and talk through it in a second. The final exam, I want to emphasize that I don't choose the date. I have no control over the date. The university chooses the date. It could be anywhere between December 6th and 20th. They usually announce it around October-ish when the schedule is, sometimes November. And It can't be moved if you have travel plans. Maybe you're going somewhere over the Christmas break or something like that. That's not a valid excuse. Okay, so I strongly recommend that you don't start booking airplanes and tickets and things like that until either the schedule is out, or if you want to be safe, you can schedule them after December 20th. Okay? Okay, in terms of the lectures themselves, the first thing we'll do is I'll sort of walk you through kind of overview of the course so you can get a sense of where it's going. I'll say a few words about it. So this is a core course. It's cryptography. Cryptography is kind of, let's face it, it's math-based. Okay, so there is going to be some math that's involved. I'm not going to assume that you're coming in with any special sort of prerequisites in terms of math. We'll sort of, you know, we'll talk a little bit about probability in the first half of the class. In the second half, it will actually switch sort of gears. So there's kind of two styles of cryptography. One is sort of based on logic, so like logical operations, sort of like algorithms, and the other is based on math formulas, okay? And the math formulas are a little more powerful, but they're slower, they're good at some things, the sort of logical stuff's better at other things, okay? So basically starting here, number theory down, this is where it kind of turns mathematical, and I'm going to teach you number theory from scratch, okay? I'm not going to assume that you know anything about it, okay? If it's a concern to you, the best thing you can do, actually a really good resource for you, is if you go to my website, first off, to find the homepage for the course, I didn't explain. It's at kind of like a long, funky URL. So what I recommend is just Google my name. I should come up. Then you can follow the links. You can click on courses and you'll see the link to this year's course website. But a good resource for you would be the course website from last year or the previous years. So if you click on that, you'll see all the notes. So if you want to sort of read ahead, the notes will be essentially exactly the same. If you want to look at the assignments or the past midterms and those types of things, you can look at it from last year's website. Okay, for the project, what you'll do is, it's going to be due the last day of class. I accept groups of two, so you can work with a partner. If there's something that you really want to do and it requires a larger group, you can come to me and try and convince me that you want to do it with a group of three or a group of four, that's fine. But by default, if you don't want to ask me or do anything, you can just do one person or two people. And I will take into account whether it's done by a single person or two people. I'll expect more if it's done in a team. So there's no penalty to working alone. If you prefer to work alone or if you want to work with a partner, that's fine as well. The idea of this is essentially to write kind of a survey. There's a bunch of stuff here that I actually don't really care about. This is stuff I wrote like 4 years ago when I first started teaching. Essentially, the first thing you'll do is you'll pick a topic. And so I have a bunch of suggested topics. These things aren't going to mean anything to you today, looking at the list. It's probably going to take you 3 or 4 weeks before they start to mean something. So don't feel that you have to, you know, get started on the project right today. But don't wait too long. Okay, you should have a good conception of what you want to do sort of before the midterm. And then starting from the midterm on, you should be actually working on it on a week-to-week basis, okay? So don't feel like you're in a big rush to choose a topic, but these are just a set of topics that I find interesting. Students, you know, usually don't struggle too much writing about any of these topics. So you're free to choose one off the list. If you want to do something that's not on the list, just bounce it off of me. I usually say yes. I just want to make sure that it's good and sufficient for a project, okay? Okay, the final thing I'll talk a bit about is plagiarism. So this is something you're going to hear from all your courses, but it's really important to understand. So in terms of both assignments and projects, assignments are meant to be done individually. So that means no talking to your friends. I understand that you're probably going to consult with your friends and you'll probably talk through it. I don't have a big problem with that. What I have a problem with is literally copying what your friend wrote down, okay? So if I get two assignments and it's verbatim, you know, the same between two of them. That's an academic offense. It's plagiarism. It's taken very seriously by the university. Cases get reported to the dean. If you get two plagiarisms that are upheld, you could be looking at expulsion. It's not strictly necessary that you will, but that's the sort of standard procedure that's in the academic code. I've sat on the tribunal that reviews these cases. And so anyways, the point is that it's very, very serious, okay? So if you're in a situation where, for example, let's say it's the night before the assignment's due and you haven't done it and you don't know how to do it, it's much better for you to take a zero on the assignment than to copy off of someone else, okay? It will be of less consequence to you, okay? That's how serious plagiarism is treated. And for your final project, it's really, really important, in particular in this type of project, because you're summarizing other people's research. It's very easy to, you know, sort of copy and paste some write-up that you see that looks interesting and you feel like maybe you couldn't word it any better than that write-up. So you might be tempted to just sort of copy and paste it in. So you can't do that, okay? So you cannot directly copy any material. You can do it to a certain extent if you quote it. So if you're like very explicit, like this is a direct quote from this source, you put in double quotes, that's allowed. But generally in these types of, in engineering, that's very uncommon, okay? And engineering themselves, like ENCS recommends that like less than, your report has to be like less than 5% direct quotes or 10%. They have some number that they put on it. But it's very atypical that you would actually directly quote something, okay? So what I recommend you do is you take your source, you read it, you understand it, and then you sort of close it down, get it out of sight, and then just repeat it back in your own words, what you understood. Okay. Another thing that is still plagiarism is if you copy sort of the idea, like say someone has a list and they're like, okay, these are the 10 important properties of this system. If you just copy that list, but maybe you change the grammar a bit, that's still plagiarism. Okay. Because you're taking someone's idea. It's not your idea. Okay. Now, the next thing I want to really emphasize is that you can write your papers in a very conversational style. They do not have to be a formal paper. Okay, so if in that example, you see this list and you're like, yes, those are the 10 properties, they're really good, I want to use them, just say it in your paper itself. Say that, you know, so-and-so suggested that this system has 10 essential properties. Okay, these are the properties that they say. Then you can list them. It's very clear that you drew those properties from that paper. And in a paper like this, because you're summarizing other people's work and surveying, I expect to see lots of citations, right? Almost nothing's going to be original in your paper. Okay, so if you have a citation after every paragraph, that's normal. Okay, so don't feel like you have to have huge blocks of text you're not citing where it came from. Okay, in these types of projects, you're going to be, you know, hopefully explaining it in a way that you understand that will be different than what the authors use in terms of explaining it. So the style of the explanation will be different, but all the ideas will be drawn from somewhere else. And so as long as you cite where they're coming from, then there's not going to be a problem, okay? So if you're in doubt about anything, just say it in your paper what you did, okay? Just tell me in words what you did. You know, I took this from here or whatever, and then there shouldn't be any issue with it, okay? Okay, is there any questions about the logistics of it? No, so for this course, it will be just the report itself. And you don't have to run, if you choose a topic that's on the list, you don't have to get my approval for it. Those are pre-approved topics. More than one person can do the same topic, that's fine. Okay, any other questions about anything before we get into the course itself? Yeah. For the project itself, so I expect a write-up. So it would be like 8, I think there is a sort of page suggestion, which closer to the project, you can quiz me about whether you can have more pages or less pages. But for now, we'll just say it's, I think, 8 pages. So that's the form I expect. If your project takes a very different deviation, like say you go and implement something and most of your project is the code itself, right? Then come and talk to me and say, hey, I'd like to just write like a 4-page paper, but then submit my like GitHub repository that has all the code because that's really the core contribution, and that would be fine. But you should pre-clear that with me if you want to deviate from it. Yeah. Or similarly, I don't know what else you would do. I don't know if you want to make an animation explaining something, or you know, if your deliverable is not a report, that's okay. I'm open to it, but you just have to come in and clear it with me first. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, sure. So I've been at Concordia, I guess, 4 years. I've taught this course ever since coming here, plus I taught it as a postdoc. So I started getting into crypto in undergrad, and then I did a master's, a PhD in cryptography. During my PhD, I worked on voting systems. In particular, we looked at applying cryptography to voting systems so that you could sort of post an encryption of your vote, take home some evidence that it's actually being counted correctly, and then prove that all the votes are being added up together so no one can change it. So that was of interest to me. And then recently I've been very involved in Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is a new digital currency. If you like Bitcoin or you want to learn more about it, I am actually teaching a course as well this term on Bitcoin. You would have missed the first class, but because I post the lecture notes and the audio, you can certainly catch up. So it's 6:30. It's on Wednesday nights. I think that conflicts. I think it conflicts with one of the other core courses. So probably not a lot of you are taking it. If it's popular this year, I'll teach it next year. So those are the two main research areas. And then I dabble in all sorts of other security, network security, Android security, you know, other cryptographic protocols and things like that. Yeah. Any other questions? Can be anything. Don't be shy.
Will you fix the U.S. election process?
I will not. I would try. But yeah, we fix it one city at a time. So we fix it for one city in the United States. But yeah, doing it at a country level would be hard.
Yes,
for sure. For sure. Any other questions or comments? Okay. All right, so we'll get into the lecture itself. Like I said, I don't have my tablet here with me, so I'm not going to do the notes live. What I'll do is I'll just pull up last year's notes, and I'll post a copy of these online, so you can take notes if you want. Normally, because I'm writing it in real time, it's a little easier to keep up. I'll try and try not to go too fast, because I'm not actually writing things down. Okay, so let's start by talking about cryptography. In particular, how's it related to security? So you're all here because you're probably in a security program, or at least you're taking courses in a security program. The way you define security is a little ambiguous. In 6150, we'll spend a lot more time thinking about what security actually is. But for now, we can use something that's not the greatest, but it's not too bad, which is called CIA. So CIA is an acronym for like three core security properties. So a lot of security comes down to confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Okay, and so cryptography can play a role in these, but it doesn't play a role in all three. So the first is confidentiality. When you think about cryptography, this is probably what you're thinking about. You're probably thinking about encrypting messages, right? So encrypting a message is kind of like, I don't know, putting it in a safe and then sending the safe to someone else who has the key, and then they're going to unlock the safe and take the message out. And if anybody's in the middle, they can look at the safe, but since they don't have a key, they can't actually open it up. They can't learn what the message is, okay? So it might be messages in transit. So Alice is sending a message to Bob. It might be messages to yourself, right? It might be messages that you store on your phone. You want it encrypted while your phone is locked. And then when you unlock it, you type in your PIN or you put your fingerprint in, then it's unlocked. Okay, so if you ever set your phone down, someone else picks it up, your messages are sort of encrypted. Okay, now it's slightly different because encryption will use things that are stronger than passwords. So I reference this idea of a key. That's the actual terminology we'll use. But in cryptography, a key is a number. It's not a physical key. And they're big numbers. They're random numbers. So they're kind of like a system-assigned password, but usually a lot longer and harder to guess. So the typical scenario, and we'll see Alice and Bob a lot. So you have some party, Alice has a message, and they kind of put their message in a box, okay, or a safe. It's protected with some number, which is a key, and it's sent to Bob. And then presumably Bob holds either the same key in one setting, or we'll talk about a slightly more complicated scenario in a little bit. But for now, let's assume he holds the same key, then he can unlock it, okay? Now, how do Alice and Bob get the same key in the first place? I don't know. Okay, there's an answer to that question, but that's going to come a lot further down the road. Okay, so in general, there's two types of encryption. There's symmetric key encryption. So symmetric key encryption means, it's a fancy way of saying that Alice and Bob have the same key, okay? So the key that you use to encrypt the message and the key that you use to decrypt the message is the same, okay? Symmetric key encryption is very fast, okay? That's its main advantage. An example of a symmetric key encryption algorithm is AES. That's the most sort of famous, and so we'll spend a lot of time or some time talking about AES, okay? So it's very quick. The problem with it is Alice and Bob have to have the same key. They have to know each other's key. They have to have somehow exchanged that key. How's that done? Do they meet in back alley somewhere and exchange keys? I don't know, okay? So that's the big kind of open problem with symmetric key encryption. But if you can arrange a scenario where Alice and Bob share the same key, then it's very fast at that point, okay? The second is what we call asymmetric key or public key. And so in public key cryptography, every person has two keys. They have one key that will encrypt messages, and they have one key that will decrypt messages. So specifically what you do is you generally pick your decryption key, and then you calculate on a key that will encrypt messages such that this decryption key that you just chose will decrypt them. And then what you can do is because the encryption key only encrypts, you can actually post it publicly. I can put it on my website and say, this is my encryption key. So anyone can come along, they can grab that key, they can encrypt a message to me. And because I'm the only one with the decryption key, I'm the only one that can decrypt it. Okay? So that's a much more sort of more powerful model because now it's a little more obvious how we solve this problem of how we end up with the same keys. Okay? And so generally what will happen is because, now these algorithms are very slow. So the first type of algorithm, the symmetric key, is, as I hinted, this is based on logic and algorithms, whereas this is based on math. It's based on number theory, okay? And it only works for really small messages, okay? But where we're eventually going is, what will happen is, you'll use public key encryption just to send a symmetric key, okay? So Alice will pick a symmetric key. She'll use public key encryption to send, instead of a message, she'll send the symmetric key encryption to Bob. Bob can decrypt it. Now they have the same symmetric key. They'll switch over, because it's way faster, they'll switch over to symmetric key encryption, okay? And so with symmetric key encryption, you can, you know, encrypt gigabytes of data. With public key encryption, we're talking about like 1,000 bits, okay? So it's a very small amount, okay? So usually we just use public key encryption to sort of swap keys, and then once we have our keys, then we switch over and we use symmetric key encryption, okay? We'll see all of this in detail, okay? So don't worry if you're not following it all right now, but this is just a preview of sort of where we're going over this course. Okay, so that's confidentiality, okay? So that's what encryption does. Now, the second thing encryption does is really important. It's equally as important as confidentiality, but a lot of people don't think of encryption as providing this property, and it's integrity. So integrity is essentially the property that, let's say Alice sends a message to Bob, so Bob gets this message. How does Bob know that the message wasn't changed in transit? Okay? Maybe it was changed by someone in the middle or a device, or maybe he's not even talking to Alice. Maybe it's someone that's impersonating Alice and sending this message. How does he know? Okay, so that's the question of integrity. So integrity, specifically message integrity, is that what you receive is exactly the same as what was sent. Okay, and so if you have this property, then you have integrity, and then you can use encryption for confidentiality. And generally what we're going to do is we're going to provide both, okay? So we're going to provide a secure message transmission system, or a secure channel, as it's called, where if you're in the middle of this channel, you can't read what's going on, that's confidentiality, and you can't change the messages either, okay? That's integrity. Or rather, you can change them, but it will be detected, okay? So it's not a prevention mechanism. And so this is another sort of important thing in security, is security generally falls into two camps. There's techniques that are prevention techniques, so they actually try and stop you from doing something bad. And then there's detection techniques that don't try and stop you, but they make it so that it's obvious after the fact that you did something bad, and then you can be penalized for it or whatever the case may be, or you retry, or, you know, there's different ways of handling it, okay? So the idea here is, and once again, we're going to go through this in lots and lots of detail, but this is just the preview, is Alice, in this case, has a message. For integrity, because we don't care about confidentiality, you can think of it as she's just sending the message in clear text, okay? You can combine it with encryption, that's fine, but integrity actually has nothing to do with confidentiality, okay? So this property is nothing about, it's nothing about keeping M secret, it's about making sure that that same M that leaves Alice's device is the same M that's received by Bob's device, okay? And what she's going to do is she's going to append something to it, a value, okay? We'll call it a tag. And this value is going to depend on the message itself, okay? So it's going to process the message in order to create the tag. And presumably, if you change the message, then the tag would also change, okay? So it will have that property. And there's going to be a key, okay? And what the key does is, in the same as in the encryption case, we're going to assume that Alice and Bob hold the same key. And if anybody's in the middle and they don't know what this key is, they will not be able to create a tag for that message, okay? So if they change the message to something else, they have to generate the tag that's different now because they changed the message, and if they don't hold this key, they're not going to be able to do it. That's the security property that we want, okay? You can think of a tag as kind of like a signature, okay? In fact, a signature is sort of the asymmetric version of a tag. And so it's like you have the message and then you sign it, and if the message changes, well, normally, you know, the signature analogy kind of breaks down, because if your signature is at the bottom of a document, right, the top of the document could change and your signature is still there, right? But in cryptography, the signature itself will take, as a function, as an input, it will take the message itself. So if the message changes in any way, the whole signature will change as well. So the signature will be dependent on the message. But anyways, for now, this is just to communicate this idea of integrity. So making sure that messages don't change both in transit, but it can also be on your computer. Like, you want to store something and you want to make sure it doesn't change when you read it back, you can use that as well. Okay. Now, there's two ways of doing this. So in the computer example, if you write a file, usually what the operating system will do, or the program that you're using to write it to disk, is they'll add something called an error correction code, okay? And an error correction code, it doesn't matter if you don't know what these are, but it's just for those of you who do, it's good to distinguish what's going on from a cryptography standpoint. Error correction codes are not cryptographic primitives, okay? What they protect against is random errors. So if there's some noise in the data, when you read it back, they'll catch that noise, okay? And they'll give you a mechanism to maybe correct for it, or at least you can know that something went wrong and then you can ask for it to be sent again, okay? But if you're an adversary with a brain that knows what the algorithm is for the error correcting code, you can take a message, you can change it, then you can change the error correcting code to match the new message, right, the modified message, and everything's good, right? Then the modified message and the modified error correcting code will go across the wire, and the person won't know that anything was changed, okay? So this is not a security tag, okay? This is just a tag against sort of random things happening, okay? In the security world, what we want to do is we want to consider adversaries that are deliberately changing messages. They know everything about the system. They know the algorithm that you're using to compute this tag. There's no secrets anywhere except for the key, okay? And so we want it all to come down to that key. If you know the key, you can make the tags. If you don't know the key, you can't make the tags, okay? So this is how it differs from error correcting codes. Okay, so we want protection against an intelligent adversary, so we're going to use what's called a keyed function. Okay, and once again, just like encryption, there's a symmetric case where Alice and Bob hold the same key, and there's an asymmetric key or asymmetric case. So in the symmetric case, they're called MAX or message authentication codes, and in the asymmetric case, they're called signatures. So a signature works the same as kind of like public key encryption. What I would do is I would post my key online. In this case, you can think of it as a verification key. So there's this key, it's on my website. And if I ever send a message to you, I'm going to sign it with a secret key that only I know, a signing key. So I'll sign that message with my signing key. I'll send it to you. You'll hold the message. You'll hold the signature. Then you'll go to my website and get my verification key, and you'll check that that verification key on that message produces that signature. Okay? But if you want to change the message, you can't re-sign it because you don't know my secret signing key. Okay, so that's the asymmetric scenario. Once again, the asymmetric scenario is more powerful than the symmetric case. Okay, so once we have this, there's no reason ever to use this, except for this is really slow. Okay, so it's the same problem as before. This is too slow, so we use it for a limited set of cases, and then we try to switch over to this case once we can to make things go faster. Okay, the final thing in CIA, so we have confidentiality, integrity. The final thing is availability. Crypto doesn't really help you with availability. Availability is like, you know, your website's up and someone's trying to take it down by doing a denial of service attack against it or something like that. There are small marginal ways where crypto could factor in, but generally it's not, you know, there's no sort of standard DDoS protection that's based on cryptography. Crypto helps a lot for confidentiality, integrity, doesn't really do much in terms of availability. Any questions so far? Feel free to interrupt at any time. And if you're thinking of a question, there's probably like five other people that have the same question. They're too shy to ask it. So, yeah. Like besides MAX and signatures? Oh, yeah, where you'd actually use it. Yeah, so I have a few coming up. So one might be, this one we'll circle back to maybe even by the end of this lecture. Let's say you go on BitTorrent, okay? And, you know, everyone here uses BitTorrent, right? And you want to download some music that's perfectly legal for you to download. It's released under a Creative Commons license, right? No problem. Or maybe it's a movie or something like that. Okay, what are you doing in BitTorrent? Well, what you're doing is you're getting this file that you're going to run on your computer. Let's say you're getting an app, like Photoshop or some free version of Photoshop, right? You're downloading that, okay? You're going to run this code on your computer. Where's this code coming from? It's coming from a random bunch of nodes on the internet, right? They could send anything, right? They could send some malicious code that would get spliced into your version of Photoshop, right? It just takes one node on the network to do that, and then all of a sudden you're running malware, and then they're going to connect to your computer and do all sorts of things, okay? So how do you make sure that the file you get is exactly the file that was supposed to be distributed via BitTorrent if you're downloading pieces from a whole bunch of different people? Okay? Yeah. Yeah, so what happens is, we won't talk about hashes, or we won't use technical language for now, but that's an integrity property, okay? So what you're going to do is, you're going to get a kind of tag of what the file looks like from the Pirate Bay or whatever your BitTorrent tracker is. So that comes down in the .torrent or the magnet link, okay? So now you have this tag. Then you're going to download all your pieces, and yeah, some of them might be good, some of them might be bad, but before you ever run anything, you're going to run over the file, and you're going to compute what the tag is, and if it doesn't match that tag that you got, then you start throwing away pieces and asking for new pieces. And so the way they do is a little more sophisticated so that you don't have to like re-download the whole thing. You kind of can find the bad chunks that got mixed in. And it's not just malicious behavior, like things can come down because of errors or propagation errors or different things like that, okay? So that's another example where you might want integrity.
For BitTorrent, do they use CRCs or do they use other checksums?
So they use hash function. specifically. Yeah. So we'll talk about hashes before we leave. Okay, any other questions? Okay. All right, so I'll just summarize this. Normally I draw this all out, so it looks kind of like, it's got like the football, like arrows and stuff going everywhere. So forget about those for a second. This is sort of the order that we're going to walk through the material. And the primary sort of, so if you take, even if you pick up the textbook, it's going to have a completely different order in terms of how they present things. I like this order because what we're going to do is we're going to zero in on keys, okay? So we talked about symmetric key encryption and symmetric key integrity, or MACs. So those have one key. And the public key version, signatures and encryption, and this other thing called key exchange, which we haven't talked about, they have two keys, okay? Then we're going to talk about a bunch of things that are actually cryptographic functions that have no keys, okay? There's no secrets that are involved, and this is a little hard to wrap your mind around, but we'll see it. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with things that have no keys. There's no keys to them at all. So hash functions, pseudo-random number generators, and something called extractors. Then we'll move into the things that have one key. So this is symmetric key encryption and MACs. And then we'll move to public key encryption and public key signature functions, okay? So your encryption functions are giving you confidentiality. Your MACs and signatures, they're giving you integrity. Everything else is a building block. It sets up sort of the scenario that allows one of those two things to work. Either it gets the keys to the right party so they can go ahead and use it, or it's inside one of these functions, okay? So, for example, a hash function is inside a key, sorry, it's inside a signature function. Okay, so it's one piece of a signature function. They're useful by themselves. Okay, we'll talk of lots of applications where you just need a hash function, but the other place they show up is actually buried inside the signature function. PRGs you can use in order to make symmetric key encryption. So there's these things called stream ciphers, and so they're based on PRGs. Extractors you're going to use when you want to do key exchange, and hashes can show up in other places as well, depending on exactly what you want to do.
Aren't they independent?
Yeah, so some of these, that's what these arrows are trying to show, is that some of them have other functions built inside of them. So if you open up, not every signature function, but for example, we'll talk about one called Schnorr DSA. If you open it up, there's a hash function sitting there. Okay, so it does something with a hash function in the middle of it. So that's sort of the dependency graph of it. So not all of them will be completely independent topics. Okay, so that's, we'll walk through all of them. So what's the sort of timeline? We'll spend 2-3 lectures on hashes. This stuff we'll talk about. Usually we get to like the start of encryption before the midterm. And then after the midterm, we usually do MACs, and then we start into the public key stuff for the second half of the course. Okay, so we're going to go really slow through these things, but this is just, and once again, these names don't mean anything to you. I don't expect them to mean anything to you. The reason this chart is here is at the end of the class, you're going to go back and you're going to be studying for the final, and then you'll look at this chart, and all of a sudden everything will like make a lot of sense, and it will click, hopefully. Okay. Now, the other thing about functions is the key part, I guess, about security is you can think of it as coming down to, let's see if I drew this out. Yeah. So a lot of these things you can think of as functions or algorithms, doesn't really matter. We'll call them functions. And basically, they have some inputs and they have some outputs, okay? And where security comes into play, or where cryptography comes into play, is what we're going to say is not just everyone can necessarily run this function, okay? Or not everyone can invert this function. So if I give you an output of the function, maybe I don't want you to be able to go back to the input of the function, okay? So different primitives will give you different properties. Some of them will allow anyone to run it forward, but nobody can run it backwards. Some of them, you need a key to run it forward, but if you could run it backwards, or you might need a key to run it backwards, but anyone could run it forward. Okay, so there's different combinations of what you might want. Okay, so once again, this is a summary that is more meaningful at the end of the course when you're coming back and reflecting on it. But just as a sort of preview, for a hash function, this is a public function that anybody can run forward. There's no keys, okay? But nobody can run backwards, okay? So you can't start with the output of a hash and figure out what the input was. That's the security property it should have. A PRG and extractors are actually the same as a hash. Strictly, this isn't strictly necessary for an extractor, but it's generally true because they're built from hash functions. But they all have the sort of the same property. Now, what differs between these three is basically the size of the inputs and outputs. Hashes take big numbers and make them small. PRGs take small numbers and make them big. Extractors also take big numbers and make them small, but have different properties in hash functions. Okay. For both encryption, just for encryption, you need a key to go in the forward direction to encrypt, and you need a key to go backwards to decrypt. If you don't have the key, you can't do either of those operations. If you have the key, you can do both of those operations. In terms of max, you need a key in order to go forward. There is no backward in max. If you want to check a Mac, the other person just runs it forward. That's a fine point that we'll get to. Key exchange doesn't really comply to this. It's not really a function. It's a protocol. And then with public key encryption, anyone can go forward. So anyone can encrypt a message, but only the person with the key can go backwards and decrypt it. It's the opposite for a signature. So only the person with the key can sign the message. But once it's signed, anyone can sort of go backwards and see that, yeah, that was the right signature. That output was right for the input of this message. Okay. So once again, we're going to spend weeks on each of these, so you'll see these properties again, but this is just sort of a preview of sort of where we're going, I guess. Okay, there's a few other things I want to talk about before we get into hash functions, which will be the first actual function that we talk about. The first thing that shows up a lot when we think about the security of cryptographic protocols is this idea of exhaustive search or brute force, okay? So let's say you have a PIN, okay? So you have a phone, old iPhone, maybe it has a four-digit PIN, and I want to guess what your four-digit PIN is. One approach I can always use is start at 000, try 001, try 002, 003, and go through all the numbers, and eventually I'll hit that number, right? So that's exhaustive search. That's what we mean. So exhaustive search is like the most naive algorithm, and it literally breaks every cryptographic protocol, okay? So every protocol on this list can be broken with exhaustive search. The trick that we're going to do is we're going to try and make the numbers so big that, you know, you'll never be able to exhaustively search it in a reasonable amount of time, okay? But technically, all of these, if you had enough time, you could break any of these things, okay? Okay. So let's say that we have a four-digit PIN. How many guesses does it take?
10 raised to the 4.
Okay, so 10 raised to the 4, or you can think of it as from 0000 to 9999, which is just is 10,000. So there's 10,000 unique PINs. If you just grab a PIN at random and you say, what's the probability that this PIN is right? Right, 8729. What's the probability that this is right? It's 1 over the total number of pins, which is 10,000. Okay. All right, now let's assume that we have an x-digit PIN, okay, where x is not 4, it could be 10, it could be whatever. It's just a variable. How do we express it in terms of a variable? Okay, so it's going to be 10 to the power of x, okay? So what you can think of is, I'll just move it up, even though it's going to show everything. Okay, 10 to the power of x. So what you have is you have x numbers or whatever the case are, okay? For each of these, you have 10 choices, okay? So you have 10 choices here, you have 10 choices here, you have 10 choices here. Anytime you have a scenario like that where you have a certain number of choices and it's repeated a certain number of times, then it's going to be the number of choices raised to the power of the number of blocks, okay? Now, in cryptography, before we get there, okay, what's the probability that you pick one pin at random and it's right? Okay, it's going to be the same. It's going to be 1 over the total number of pins. So if there's 10 to the x pins, it's going to be 1 over 10 to the x. Okay? Is everyone okay with that? Okay, or we might write it as 10 to the minus x, which is equivalent to it. Okay? Now, you have to get really comfortable with this because we're going to bounce back and forth between this. You're going to see a lot of things that look like this and a lot of things that look like this. The main difference is instead of them being tens, they're going to be twos. Okay, so normally we consider binary numbers in cryptography, and so these are bits. Okay, so a bit is exactly the same as this, except for instead of 10 choices, you have two choices. It's either 0 or 1 or 0, 1, 0, 1. Okay, so if this was a bit string and it was x bits long, then it's going to be 2 to the x. Okay, so you'll see that type of number along a lot. And if you just pick one x bit string and ask, what's the chances that this matches, you know, a set string? It's going to be 2 to the minus x, okay? All right, so for example, just to make sure that we really get this, let's say you have an 8-character password, and let's say that each character of the password can be a lowercase, uppercase, number, or special character, so there's 33 of those characters, okay? How many passwords are there? I don't know why I wrote 95. Why did I write 95? Okay, I think this was just a typo. Sorry, anyways. Okay, so what we should have is 33 raised to the power of 8. I apologize for that. Oh, sorry, so the 33 special characters. I understand. Yeah, okay. My apologies. Yeah, this is what happens when I just read off the notes. Okay, sorry. So there's 33 special characters, plus there's 10 numbers, plus all your uppercase and all your lowercase numbers. So there's 95 characters in total. It's an 8-character password, so you can imagine 95 of these repeated 8 times. So it's going to be 95 raised to the power of 8. So it's a big number. Okay, this is the number of characters. And if we convert it into bits, it's 2 to the power of 53, approximately. Okay, how do we get that number 53? So we have this number, and we want to know 2 to the power of what gives us 53? Okay, so we're going to take the logarithm base 2. Okay, so the logarithm of this base 2 will give us 53. So that means 2 to the 53 equals this. Okay. So moving back and forth between absolute numbers and powers of 2, that's also something we'll do a lot. Okay. 2 to the 53 is a big number. But it's not a huge number. Okay. So just to give you a sense, I mentioned at the start of class, I work a lot on Bitcoin. You can buy these Bitcoin, like special hardware that's used in the protocol for creating Bitcoins. They're called miners. And so one of them, for example, if it was a hash and you're trying to find the right value that outputs this hash, it could search this space 2 to the 53 in 8 minutes, and it costs $2,500. Okay? And that's like even old, like as of last year. So you can probably do it a little bit faster this year. Okay, so the idea is that this number is you know, it's sort of big, but not that big. Okay, now what we'd like to do is we'd like to make this so big that you couldn't buy any hardware today at any reasonable price that's going to be able to exhaustively search this. Okay, so let's say that, for example, this antminer, it takes, you know, 8 minutes to do 2 to the 53. Let's say that somehow we were able to add one bit. So instead of this number, we multiplied it by 2. We doubled the password space. So now instead of it being 6 quadrillion or whatever that is, it's now 12. Okay? So we just doubled it. Okay? What does this number turn into? So now it's 2 to the 53. What does it go to? 2 to the 54. Okay? So if it goes up by 1, then it doubles. Okay? Now it's going to take 16 minutes. Okay, if we double it again, we go 2 to the 55, then it's going to take twice as long. Okay, and the key thing about that type of growth, that's called exponential growth, where it doubles. Okay, so every time you increment this number by 1, you're doubling the amount of space. Things get really big, really fast. Yeah. So that's a good question. So in crypto, we don't care because the difference isn't that important. So let's go back to the four-digit PIN. So the question is, you know, how long does it take to guess this PIN? Well, if it takes 10,000, that means like the PIN was the last one that you tried, right? But on average, you're going to find it about half of the time that it takes to exhaust the whole search. Okay, so you'll get lucky. Sometimes you'll find it, you know, sooner than 10,000 times. Usually you'll always find it sooner than 10,000 times. Sometimes you'll find it faster than half of 10,000, sometimes longer than half of 10,000. So on average, expectation or expected value of a brute force is always half of the maximum number. Okay, so on average, you'll find it in half the time. Now, what that's going to do is it's going to turn a number like 2 to the 53 into 2 to the 52. Because it's a half, right? So you'll take one number off. And that number, that's so like inconsequential that normally we just forget about it. So normally we just talk about worst case because it's the simplest to understand. But certainly on a test or something like that, if you gave me average case instead of worst case, I wouldn't take any marks off for that. Okay. Okay. So what we want is we want to find what's the number up here where a computer can't conceivably do it. Okay, what's sort of the maximum? So we know that computers, I mean, you need special hardware, it's pretty expensive to do 2 to the 53. How big does this 53 have to get before we sort of hit the limit? Okay, where we hit the limit where we can't do anything fast enough, okay? So as we mentioned, every time you increment this by one, it doubles, so it gets twice as hard. Okay, so it's getting a lot harder, a lot faster. Okay, so the threshold, no one knows for sure, but the threshold's about 2 to the 70, okay? So if you have 2 to the 70, then it's sort of, you know, like no computer known today can really do 2 to the 70, or even if you have a cluster of GPUs or something like that, some sort of special hardware cluster of ASICs, they're not going to be able to do 2 to the 70, okay? So that's sort of just at the cusp of being infeasible. Yeah. Yeah. So I forget if Antminer's GPU. I think it's ASIC. So I think it's faster. Is it ASIC? Yeah. Yeah. So it's ASIC based. So it's special circuit, takes one clock cycle. So a GPU can't even compete with it. Yeah. Yeah. So it's specialized for a particular hash function that's used within Bitcoin. Correct, yeah, yeah. So this is a circuit that's custom built with exactly what Bitcoin does. That's the circuit. It only computes that. It's not good for anything else. Yeah. Whereas a GPU, you could reprogram it, right? So basically, if you want to talk about computer hardware, the more specific, the less flexible the thing is, the faster it is. So an ASIC means like you hard code the circuit. It only computes that circuit really, really fast. Something like a GPU or an FPGA, you can reprogram it with lots of different things. It's not quite as fast, but it's still pretty fast. Yeah. Okay, so 2 to the 70 is sort of the threshold between sort of feasible and infeasible. And so what we like to do as cryptographers is we like to be really conservative. So if we're thinking, you know, 2 to the 70 is sort of where we're at, we want to put in a safety margin, okay? So we want to get our algorithms where, like I said, all of them you can break through brute force, okay? But we're going to make them big enough so that it's really hard to break through brute force. So we're going to get it well above 2 to the 70 just to give us some room in order so that we don't have to change our algorithms every couple of years. So what NIST recommends currently is 2 to the 112 as sort of the bare minimum, okay? So if something is 2 to the 112, NIST is a organization in the United States, National Institute for Standards and Technology. They define, you know, what's an inch, right? They'll have like a piece of metal that at a certain temperature is exactly an inch and it's kept in this like very safe room. Okay, so that's the kind of stuff they're into, standardization, and they dabble in cryptography as well. So they produce recommendations primarily for the government and they'll say things have to be 2 to the 112, okay? Now, if you're going to brute force some bit string. Let's say we have some bit string, and the amount of time it takes to brute force it is 2 to the 112. How long is that bit string? So I have some binary number, okay? And you're going to try every number until you get the right one, and it's going to take you 2 to the 112 attempts, this is worst case, to find that binary number. How big is that binary number? So let's cheat and look back here. Okay. So here we said to the x, if something takes, if there's 2 to the x of them or it takes 2 to the x to exhaustive search, then it's an x bit number. Okay. Exactly. So something's 2 to the 112. If it takes 2 to the 112 work, that means it's 112 bits long. Okay. So what we'll do is I'll just get in the habit of sometimes I'll say 112 bits of security. What does that mean? 112 bits means it takes 2 to the 112 amount of work to guess it. Or if you're to pick one value at random, the probability of it being right is going to be 1 over 2 to the 112 or 2 to the minus 112. Okay, so get very comfortable, like sort of switching between 112 bits is 2 to the 12 possible values is 2 to the minus 112 probability of guessing correctly. Okay, so those three are sort of all equivalent, and it's usually easy from the context to follow along. So sometimes you'll see 2 to the 112, sometimes you'll just see 112s, but that's the difference between those three values. Okay, so 112-bit key, you're not going to be able to brute force it. What does that mean? It means you take all the computers that are like available today and you get all of them trying to brute force this on the Earth. You let it run for a million years or a billion years. It's not going to find the right value, okay, unless if it gets really, really lucky, okay? So that's sort of the order of magnitude that we're talking about, okay? Because of exponential growth, 2 to the 112 is such an enormous number compared to 2 to the 70, okay? It doesn't look like a big difference, okay? But this is like doubling, you know, 112 minus 70 times, okay? And that grows really, really quickly, okay? The number of like grains of sand on the Earth, I think, is like 2 to the 40 or something like that, okay? So this is like how many possible values there are is just enormous. You can't even conceive of how big they are. Okay, so just to reemphasize, 2 to the 112 passwords means it's a 112-bit key, means the probability of guessing is 1 over 2 to the 112 or 2 to the minus 112. Okay, so those three kinds of notations will bounce between. Okay, another aside that I'll do before we get into the lecture itself, I just want to give you an overview of sort of how I teach, because it's slightly different from what you would get in a different course. So for example, we're about to talk about hash functions. So in a typical course, they might show you, okay, a hash function is like, I don't know, SHA-256. Here's what it looks like inside. You know, you take this value and XOR it with this value or whatever. And then they show you the whole algorithm. And then maybe at the end, they talk about what it's actually doing. I'm going to do the exact opposite. It's actually not really that important how it works on the inside. I'm going to show you how it works on the inside just to convince you that it's real, okay? But the most important thing is how you use it. You're never going to, you should never code one of these things up yourself, okay? If you're ever going to use a hash function and you're like, okay, I've got to like implement SHA-256, you're doing it wrong, okay? There's libraries, the libraries have been tested. You should be calling someone else's implementation of SHA-256, okay? It comes on every operating system. It's in every single language. It's like very standard. There's a lot of subtle things that can go wrong if you misimplement it, like timing issues and things like that can cause all sorts of security things, okay? The most important thing for you to understand is what does it do for you, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to start by just saying there's this thing. We don't know what it does, what it looks like on the inside, but these are the inputs and these are the outputs, okay? What goes in, what comes out. Then what are the properties, okay? Things go in, things come out. Well, they have some properties. Like, you know, something comes in and comes out, but you can't go backwards, right? Or a big thing goes in and a small thing comes out, okay? That's what I mean by properties, okay? So we'll really get a grip on what this is actually trying to do. What is it trying to provide you in terms of security? And only then will we start to look inside. And even when we look inside, sometimes we won't look all the way inside. Sometimes these are very kind of modular designs. So sometimes we'll kind of drop down one level and we'll see, you know, if we keep a couple of black boxes, we can start to see some of how it works. And then there's maybe some relevant properties. Like maybe these properties aren't exactly correct, or they lead you kind of to think the wrong thing. And when we start to see some of the structure of what's inside, then you can see how you're sort of misled. So for hash functions, that would be something called length extension attacks. And then finally, what I'll do is I will show you what it looks like inside. I'll usually do it very quickly. I'll stress that you don't have to memorize it or do anything for it on the exam. And so it will just be like, okay, here's what it looks like. You'll look at it and be like, whatever. I mean, like, there's all this stuff going on. I don't really understand it. I don't understand it. I mean, I've been in cryptography for, I don't know, 15 years. And like, this stuff doesn't make sense to me. You have to be like, that's a specialty of cryptography, a subfield of cryptography, designing these protocols and making sure that when you XOR instead of ORing, instead of ANDing, that doesn't break some security property. Okay, that's like really involved, nitty-gritty cryptanalysis. You can do that. You can look at that for your class project if you want. But anyway, that's not my particular expertise. Okay, so this stuff is like, you know, rocket science, literally. Actually, not literally, but anyways. And usually what we'll do is when I show you the inside of them, I'll usually pick like really old things just because they're easier to show. I can show it kind of in one page. I don't have to, you know, we don't have to spend a really long time. Okay, so I won't even necessarily show you the most modern version of these things because the emphasis is really not on what goes on inside. Okay, another thing that just cued in my mind when I said, you know, you don't have to memorize it for the exam. For your final exam, you will have a cheat sheet. It'll be one page of paper. You can write whatever you want on that piece of paper, and you can bring it into the final exam. Okay? Don't give it on the midterm, I don't think. I have to double check. But anyway, for the final anyways, you'll definitely have that. And so you're not going to have to memorize anything. If there's something you're sitting there like, I have to memorize this before the exam, just write on your sheet and bring it in. Okay? Yeah?
Is the final for all the classes, or from like midterm?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So the midterm obviously will be from the start to the midterm. The final will include some midterm material for two reasons. One is I do want the final to be somewhat comprehensive, but the emphasis will not be on the pre-midterm material. The other thing that you'll see is that the things that we talk about before the midterm are going to show up again after the midterm. So when we talk about signatures, there's going to be a hash function there. So if I say nothing before the midterm and then you see a hash function because it's in a signature, which we did talk about after the midterm, you're going to complain, right? So it's sometimes hard to delimit like what actually is before midterm and what's after midterm. But I'm not out to test you, like play tricks and like really test you hard on pre-midterm stuff. Yeah. Yeah, you'll have lots of time to ask me about the exam before it. Okay, is there any questions so far? Okay, this is much faster because I don't have to write down everything, but anyways. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll talk for maybe another 10 minutes and then we'll take a break and then we'll come back. Okay, so what I want to introduce you to is what's called a hash function. Okay, so this is the first primitive that we're going to talk about, okay? Now, forget all the arrows and all the things in red and blue. Just concentrate on the y equals h of m for now. So this is a very simple function, okay? It takes one input. This input is y, and it gives you one output, and this output is m, okay? The input, should be m. Okay, yeah, sorry. So in this notation, m is the input in this case. Yeah, so you could say y equals h of x if you want, if that helps you. The reason I use m here is generally we're going to use m to denote a message. A lot of times we'll be working with messages, so we'll be encrypting them or hashing them, so that's why you'll see m a lot. Okay? Y equals h of m. So we have one input, we have one output. Okay? What do we want to say about these things? Okay, the first thing is just in terms of terminology, the input, sometimes we'll refer to it as a message. If you want the technical term, we call it the pre-image, or because I'm more direct, I'll just call it the input. Okay, but sometimes we'll see this term pre-image, which is just a really fancy way of saying input. Okay, so that term will come up later. The output is called the output or the image. So you have the pre-image and then the image. Or sometimes people will refer to the hash. So they'll say the hash of the message. What does that mean? It means you took the message, you ran it through the hash function, and you got a particular output from that hash. Okay? So that's the notation. Now this function, I can't emphasize this enough, because a lot of people, they think cryptography is about like secret functions, right? Like I have this secret hash function that's only on my computer and nobody else knows what it is, okay? There's never any secrets in cryptography in terms of the functions. Every function will be fully specified, public. Everyone will know about it. You can read it on Wikipedia. It'll be implemented on your computer. The only secret you'll ever see is the key. Okay, so there'll be some value, and they'll say, keep this value a secret. That's the only secret. Cryptography didn't always work this way. Okay, so in the early days of encryption, it was about hiding the algorithm itself. And that hasn't even completely gone away. So we do see companies that sometimes, you know, on like smart cards or things like that, they'll have some secret algorithm. Okay, but you can reverse engineer algorithms so easily. You can look at the circuit under a microscope. You can use machine learning to like extract what it is. There's all sorts of ways of doing it. So that technique is not really used that widely. Okay, so this hash function is a public function. You can look it up. I'll show it to you eventually in a couple of lectures. I'll show you how to run it on your operating system. Everyone has the exact same. If you hash a message on your computer, I hash a message on my computer, we're going to get the same output. Okay? So there's nothing secret about this function at all. Okay? All right, so we have a message, we hash it, and then we get an output. Okay? Now, what about the sizes of these things? Okay, so this is where we start to get into the functionality of this hash function. So it's going to do something very specific for us. Okay, and I'll talk about what those properties are in a second. But just at a high level, the message can be any size. Okay, so this message could be it could be a really small value. It could be a 0 or a 1. It could be 1 bit. Okay, it could be a really big value. It might be your entire hard drive. Okay, like the whole hard drive you run through this function. There's actually sensible reasons why you might want to do that. Okay, so the message could be gigabytes big. Okay, so the message can be any size. But the output will always be a fixed size, okay? So you're going to get a fixed size output. It doesn't matter if the input's big or small. The output will always be the same, okay? The output will be d bits long. Just to give you a preview, for d, you can think of values like 256 bits, okay? I talked about SHA-256. That's the name of a hash function. The reason it's SHA-256 is because its output is 256 bits, okay? The number of bits of the output is consequential, very consequential, and we'll talk about how you get that number. But until we talk about that, you can just think of it as a fixed value, okay? So you can take your whole hard drive and reduce it to this 256-bit value. You could take a value that's already 256 bits and hash it, it would give you 256. If you take a value that's smaller than 256, like say 50 bits, then you're actually increasing the value. The point is you're always getting 256 bits out, okay? And what this function is going to do, without getting too into the details yet, is it's going to give you a kind of fingerprint, okay? So you have a piece of data, and it's almost always the case that you're taking big data and creating a small value, okay? It's exceptional when you take a small value and make it big. You're almost always doing the inverse, but what you're doing is you're basically, like, think of BitTorrent again. You have this big movie, right? It's a couple gigabytes. And what you're going to do is you're going to run it through this function, and it's going to give you this, like, fingerprint value, okay, this 256-bit value. And the idea is if you hold this 256-bit value, and you hold a candidate that might be the movie, it might not be, you can basically run it through this function and check whether it matches or not. Okay, and it's going to be really hard to find another movie that's going to hash to that same value. Okay, so it's going to give you some of that integrity property. Okay, so we're going to formalize what exactly I just said in terms of what does the math look like in terms of the property itself. But we'll do that after a break. So it's 7:03, so we'll take a 10-minute break, come back at 7:10. We'll get started again. All right, so just to recap, we have this hash function h. It's going to take an input or a message or a pre-image. It's going to give an output image. Yoplib will be a fixed size, d bits long. Generally, think of it as sort of 256 bits. And what a hash function does at sort of a high level is it creates a fingerprint for the input. Okay, so the input could be, you know, a file on your computer. It could be an email. It could be lots of any digital data that you want could create a hash of. Files, images, movies. Okay, now let's think a little bit about what this looks like. So let's say that this is the set of all inputs. Okay, so we have this big circle and we have a bunch of dots in the circle. This is every possible input. Okay, what the hash function is doing is it's taking an input and it's mapping it to a particular output. Okay, so if this is the set of all outputs, we have this circle and we have a bunch of dots. Okay, now how many dots are inside this circle? Well, if it's d bits long, then there's 2 to the d possible values, okay? So if it's a 256-bit output, then it's 2 to the 256 output values, okay? So that's a lot of values, right? Remember, computers can do 2 to the 112 work, so that's like more than, you couldn't even search through all of these if you wanted to, okay? But it's still a very small number in terms of representation. It's a 256-bit value, okay? What does that mean? That means you write down 01000111, whatever, in binary, there's only 256 of those, okay? So that's like something that you could easily write down, you know, on a piece of paper, okay? And you don't have to represent it in binary. Just because it's binary, you can convert it to hex or to base64 or whatever it is. And so it's going to be this big, you know, like if it was 12 points long, okay? So it's a large number of values, but it's a short value to represent that particular value, okay? Now, the inputs, we said, they can be any size. So technically, it's infinite, okay? So you have this infinite space, okay? So what must happen is if you are taking these things from an infinite space, from a huge space, and you're mapping it down to a small fixed size space, it has to be the case that there's going to be 2 different inputs that map to the same output, okay? There's not enough outputs for that not to be the case, okay? There's more inputs than outputs, so there has to be some doubling up. Okay, in fact, there's going to be a lot of doubling up if this is infinite. Okay, so what we said is this hash function is supposed to be kind of like a fingerprint for a file. Okay, so think again in terms of BitTorrent, right? That's actually a good example. I'm downloading this movie. I have the hash of it. Okay, so that means that the movie looks like this. The 8 gigs of or 2 gigs of the movie, you know, that's this value here, right? It comes out to this value. There is some other movie out there, right? Maybe it's not exactly 2 gigs. Maybe it's 100 gigs. Maybe it's 50 megs, right? But there is some other movie out there that does hash to the same value, right? If that movie like had malware in it, or if there's some way for me to kind of choose that value, that would be useful, right? Because then it would foil your attempts at trying to detect that you're getting the right value, okay? So what we want to do is we want to start locking down some security in terms of what these functions look like, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to define 3 properties. 2 of them are related to each other. It's sort of a strong and a weak version of the same property. So at the end of the day, we really have 2 core ideas, okay? The first core idea is if you start here at the output, then you can't find all the inputs that map to that output. In fact, you can't even find 1, okay? So if you start at the output, you shouldn't be able to reverse the function and find an input that will give you that output, okay? So you can't go backwards. You can start with an input, and it's easy to find the output, but you can't pick an output and say, which inputs map to that output, okay? So it's going to be a one-way function, okay, or an irreversible function. Okay, so this is called pre-image resistance. That's the technical term for it, but it just means it's one way. Can't undo it. Okay, you can go in one direction, you can't undo it. Okay, now there is going to be some limits to that in terms of one thing you can do is you can keep trying inputs until you find one that comes out to the value you want. Okay, so you can always break that property through exhaustive search. Remember, exhaustive search always works. Okay, but there's no way short of exhaustive search from going backwards in terms of this function, okay? So that's pre-image resistance. The other thing that sounds like sort of saying the same property in a different way, technically I'll show you that it's a slightly different property, is it should be impossible to find two different inputs that map to the same output. Okay, so you shouldn't be able to pick two inputs. You can have full control over what they are. You can choose them to look a certain way with a certain structure, whatever you want to do. You shouldn't be able to find two possible inputs that map to the same output. Okay, if you find two inputs that map to the same output, we call that a collision. Okay, that's the term that we use. And so collisions do exist, right? They have to exist because the input space is bigger than the output system, okay? So we're not saying there aren't collisions. We're just saying it's hard to find them, okay? It's going to be infeasible to find them. It's going to be 2 to the 112 at least work to find them, okay? So they're there, but you can't find them, okay? And it's literally like they don't exist. Like, we've had this hash function, SHA-256, for years, decades, and no one has found a collision for it. Okay, if you just went on the internet today and said value A, blah, 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 value B, blah, 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 and you hash both of them and they both come out to the same value, you would be like the most famous person in cryptography, at least for a week. But
there are two images, they have the same amplifier.
Yeah, exactly. So SHA-256 is a modern secure hash function. And so there are older hash functions. Okay, so one thing we'll talk about is hash functions change over time, and that's true of any cryptographic function. Okay, and what happens is we tend to break them over time kind of slowly. So MD5 is an old hash function. And so first off, it's not even, well, we'll get to there. It's not even big enough to be secure just based on the size itself. But anyway, what ends up happening is people slowly over time, they find what are called partial collisions. So that means that they don't come out to exactly the same value, but they come out with like really close. Like a lot of the bits are the same. And then the partial collisions get like closer and closer and closer. And then finally someone comes out with one collision. Now, just because you find one collision doesn't mean you can go and get people downloading your malware, because the two inputs that you found are just random values, okay? It's not like a movie and a movie plus malware, okay? Then there's another period where cryptographers get better and better, and they start finding what are called meaningful collisions. So we're going to take a movie, we're going to put some malware in it, and we're going to like mess around with some numbers in the malware version, and both of these are going to come out to the same value. So that's like a meaningful collision. And then that takes, you know, a couple years on top of it, okay? So MD5, MD4 broken, SHA-256 not broken, SHA-1, I think, yes. There was some recent news, I think they found collisions in SHA-1, and then there's a new one called SHA-3, which is secure, but it's only been around for two or three years. So salts are related to hashes. So we'll talk about that when we talk about a use case. So a use case for hashes is storing passwords. Salts are something that you use when you store passwords for a very specific reason that we'll talk about. Yeah. So hang on to that question. Yeah. It's 160 bits output, I think. Is it 128? Okay. 128. Yeah. If you hash, yeah, good question. No. So encryption and hashing are different. So sometimes people will confuse the two, and they'll talk about hash passwords, or they'll say encrypted passwords when they really mean hash passwords. So encryption is a distinctively different thing. It looks like it. So encryption is also a very simple function. It has an input, which can be any size. It has some output called the ciphertext. There's some function. But the key difference is there will be a second input, which will be the key. So this thing doesn't have a key. So that's one difference. And then the properties that you expect from it are going to be different as well. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Okay, so here's some of the hashes that I just mentioned. So we have MD4, MD5, they're both broken. SHA-1 is broken now. SHA-2 is many years old. It's still secure as far as we know, and should be secure, you know, for the next short term, couple of years anyways. SHA-2 you can find implemented anywhere. Any library has it. It's been around long enough. SHA-3 was standardized maybe 3 years ago or 4 years ago, so you should probably be able to find implementations of SHA-3 in most major libraries by now. But if you can't find SHA-3, you can use SHA-2, and SHA-2 is fine. SHA-3 is a better construction. It's a completely different... So actually, all four of these, they're all based on something that we'll talk about called the Merkle Dam Guard construction, which is named for the two people that invented it. It has this problem called length extension attacks, which we'll talk about. SHA-3 does this completely different construction called a sponge. Doesn't have that particular attack. That's something we'll look at as we move through this. Okay. All right, so a secure hash function, what we're looking for it is three properties. So I hinted at what these three properties are. Pre-image resistance is the idea that it's one way, okay? So that you can't, if I give you an output, you can't find the input or a input that hashes to that output. Collision resistance is that you can't find two inputs that hash to the same value. Collision resistance comes in a strong form and a weak form. In the strong form, you're allowed to choose both the values, and in the weak form, you're only allowed to choose one of the two. So it makes a difference in terms of, so it's easier to break collision resistance than weak collision resistance. This, I'll give a little aside. It frustrates me a little bit when you use terms like weak, because there's actually sort of two positions. There's the person who makes the hash function, okay? So weak property sounds like something that would be like easier to achieve. Then there's the attacker, and it's the exact opposite. So for the attacker, a weak property is, it's easier to break, okay? And so you have to think about whether weak in this case means the designer. Is it weak as far as the designer is concerned, or is it weak as in terms of the attacker is concerned, okay? So collision resistance is easier to attack than weak collision resistance, okay? In terms of your cryptographic algorithm, it's easier to get this property, okay? Because this property is a lot harder to attack, and it's a lot harder to get this property because it's easier to attack, okay? So weak in this case is in terms of the designer of the algorithm, not the attacker. It always confuses you. Don't worry about it. You'll just memorize the definitions or write them on your cheat sheet. Collision resistance has two inputs. And weak has two as well, but you only choose one of them. The other one has to match a given one. So I'll give you the actual definitions eventually. Okay.
What the collision resistance, they're between worlds. So the two inputs would be the same thing, or I mean, like two same movies, or that would be different types.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll define it, but collision resistance, just in words, is two different inputs. So the inputs can't be, the same input will always produce the same output. That's actually a valid point, or something that I sort of glossed over. So let me go back and make that point. So I mentioned that this is deterministic. What does deterministic mean? Deterministic means same input, same output, okay? So if you hash the same message over and over and over, you're going to get the same result every time. Not every algorithm's like that. Some algorithms are randomized, meaning that you encrypt the same message 10 times, you get 10 different answers, okay? So we will see both deterministic and randomized. But anyways, back to your question. In collision resistance, we're looking for two different M's that are not the same, that give the same Y. And we'll write that down in a sec. Any other concerns? Okay.
Well, does it matter if it is deterministic or random? I mean, power-wise.
What-wise? Power-wise?
I mean, which one is more powerful?
Yeah. So in this case, usually randomization gives you extra properties that you don't get. So you can think of randomize as being more powerful. And that's generally true just in terms of algorithms themselves. So randomization, it will be slow in the sense that you'll take an extra input, which will be the random factor. And so it's going to be a more complicated...
In order to be producing different outputs.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So it will be of greater complexity. So the output space will be bigger because the same thing can... What you'll end up is, like, this could map to 10 different things in the output.
You just make the output size really big.
Yeah, it'll be bigger by the size of the randomness itself. Yeah. So we'll go through this... Okay, so I didn't say the smaller the system, the more secure it is. And it actually turns out that the bigger D is, the more secure it is. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through an exercise where we try and calculate what this value of D should be. And there's going to be a floor on that value. So it has to be bigger than a certain value, otherwise it's not secure. Yeah, and if you look at these things, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. So this one was, I forget what someone said, 128, I think. This one must have been the one that was 80 bits or something like that. And anyways, SHA-256 is like 256 or 512 bits of SHA-512, and SHA-3 is the same as well. Yeah. That's right, that's right. So we'll never see a randomized anything until we get to encryption. That's right, that's right. Yeah, so that's what deterministic means. Right, yeah. Yeah, so if we all are running the same hash on the same value, we'll all get the same answer. Yeah. Yes? Okay, yeah, so we'll define them. I'm just giving the list until we get there, but since you're asking about it. In collision resistance, you pick any two M's that go to the same Y. And weak collision resistance, I give you one M, and you have to find another M that goes to the same Y. So it's a slightly different formulation. Yeah, but we'll get there. Okay, so pre-image resistance is our first property. So let's write down a not so technical, but a sort of definition of what it is. Okay, so given Y is the output of the function, or the image of the function, or the hash. And Y is going to be D bits long. It's going to be infeasible to find some input that hashes to that Y. Okay, so it's going to be infeasible to find some input that hashes to it. Okay, or some X such that the hash of X equals Y. Okay, now there's two things that are maybe a little weird about this definition. Okay, the first thing is, note we use this term infeasible. That's not the same as impossible. Okay, impossible means you can't do it. Infeasible means you can do it. I can write down the algorithm that will allow you to do it. It's just the runtime of that algorithm is going to be greater than 2^112. Okay, so it's going to take a really long time to do it. Okay, so everything in crypto, with the exception of one thing we'll talk about called one-time pads, we're going to be talking about infeasible. Okay, or it's called computational security. Okay, meaning that you have to do some enormous amount of computation to break the system. Okay, there is such a thing as perfect security, but it's so restrictive in terms of what you can do. No one uses it in practice because it's not feasible in terms of like just the logistics of it. The other thing is, note that I didn't say, you know, find the input that gives you a particular output, because there's more than one of them. Okay. And so there is no notion of what's the input that gives you this output. If I hash a file, or like say I hash a file and I give you the output, that file is an input that will give you that output, but there's lots of other ones. So for this property, we don't care which one you find. You can find any input that matches that output, okay? There's no notion of the right input, okay? So what that means is it's actually easier to attack the system, okay? So it's a property that's stronger from the designer's perspective, because they have to stop you from finding any input, not just like one specific input, okay? So that's just a little finesse that doesn't really make a big difference. Okay, so the intuition of this is that this is a one-way function, okay? So you can start with your X, you can calculate your Y. It's anyone can do it, it's a public function. How fast is it? Really, really fast. You know, you can do it in like a clock cycle if your hardware supports it, which most chips do. So like, you know, as you could see from this miner that we mentioned way up here, they can do like 2 to the 53 hashes in 8 minutes. Okay, so hash functions are really, really fast. It's trivial to compute it. Okay, but to go backwards, it's going to be infeasible. Okay, you're not going to be able to actually go backwards. Okay, so the question is, how hard is it to actually go backwards? So let's say we want to, I hinted that we can use brute force to solve this problem, okay? So how hard is it, how much brute forcing would we have to do in order to go backwards, okay? Now, before I show you the algorithm, let's try and just get a kind of grip on it intuitively, okay? So it's going to have to do with something to do with the output size of the hash function. So we said the output size is D. We didn't lock down D. I suggested that in practice it ends up being something like 256 bits, okay? But this is going to be very relevant to this discussion. So just as a thought experiment, let's assume that the output size is 1, okay? So we have a hash function, and it hashes to an output size of 1 bit, okay? In other words, it hashes to a 0 or it hashes to a 1, okay? Now, there's nothing wrong with that, okay? In terms of this definition, before we get to the security properties, just in terms of it takes any size input, it maps to something that's fixed size. In this case, the fixed size is 1. That's legitimate, okay? That's a hash function. We can consider this as a hash function. How hard is it to break the pre-image resistance of a hash function that's 1 bit? So let's think of what the definition is. Okay? So in other words, you have some y, okay? So y is either going to be a 0 or 1. Let's say it's a 1. So I give you 1. And I say, find some value that when you hash it, it comes out to 1. How many values are you going to have to try? Okay. Right, so what's going to happen is you're going to try one value, and it's going to come out as either a 0 or a 1. Probably, we can think of it as like a 50-50% chance, okay? So let's say it comes out as 0, then you try a second value. Now, it could come out as 0 in that case. You could keep getting zeros, but eventually you're going to get a 1, and then you've broken it, okay? So on expectation, you try like two values, right? One will come out 0, one will come out 1, and then you've broken it, okay? So what we did in that, like, little analysis is, first off, we assumed that the hash function was kind of a random function. Okay, it was kind of like tossing a coin, was the analogy I gave. That's a really nice way of thinking of a hash function. So think of a hash function as you have some input, and then for the output, it's just random. It's just like someone sat there and flipped D coins and wrote down whatever number that was, and that now that's the output for that input. Okay. Maybe that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'll come back to it, okay? So anyways, in the extreme case that you have a 1-bit output, you know, you don't have to try very many values before you expect to find something that comes out at what you're looking for, which is either a 0 or a 1, okay? So in the extreme case, it's very easy to break, okay? Now, let's think about the general case. So in the general case, you have some D bits that are output. What's the probability that it comes out to a particular value? Okay, so let's think about why it comes out to this value. Okay, so I give you some output Y, and I say, okay, find something that hashes to it. So you try the first file. You grab the first file in your computer, and you hash it, okay? It's going to come out with some number. Okay, this is either going to be a 0 or a 1. Doesn't matter. Let's say it's 0. Let's say this is the string I give you to match. Okay, what's the probability that this is 0? It's going to be a half, right? Half the time it'll come out as 0, half the time it'll come out as a 1. Okay, what's the probability that this happens to be a 1? It's going to be a half. What's the probability that this happens to be a 1? Okay, and so the probability, what's the probability that this is a 0, this is a 1, and this is a 1? So it's going to be a half times a half times a half, okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to get half for every single one of these. You're going to get the product of all of these halves. Okay. And how many of these are there? There's d of them, right? So you're going to get d a half. So a half times a half times a half d times, it's going to be 1 over 2 to the d. Okay. Or you can think of it as 1 over 2 to the d if you want. That's equivalent. Or you can think of it as 2 to the minus d. All three of them are feasible. Okay?
Your input is the same left with output.
So in this case, there's two outputs on the board. So this is the output I give you. I say, find some input that matches this. We don't care if the input is sitting here. It can be any size. So we're not representing the input as all. Yeah. And then the output, the h of x, will be the same size as the one I give you. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about this? Yeah, sure. Let me go through it twice. It's important to get this because we're going to do things just like this that are a little more complicated. Come to you and I say, here's a value, it's c bits long. Let's make it concrete, 128 bits. So that's 256. Okay, so I give you some value and I say, find anything on earth that hashes to that exact value. Okay, so when you hash it, it hashes that value. Okay, so what you do is you do an attempt. So you choose some number or file or whatever, x1, and you compute the hash of x1. Okay. And what I want to know is, what's the probability that it just happens to come out to that number? Okay. So it will happen with some probability. What exactly is that probability? Well, it's going to be the probability that the first bit happens to come out to a zero, and that's going to happen with probably a half. Okay. Half the time it will be zero, half the time it will be one. So the probability that this equals zero is a half. The probability that you get a one here is also going to be a half. The probability you get a one here will also be a half. All the way down. Okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to have a half times a half times a half times a half. How many times? 256 or D. So D in this case is 256. Okay. So you're going to have a half times a half times a half. You're going to have 256 as B. So that's going to be 1 over 2 to the 256. 1 over 2 to the 256, sorry. And, sorry, what is this number again? So it's not exactly that. Although that's what we want to do. So I want to convert it into that number.
So this is the probability to guess.
Okay, so this is the probability that xi, that the hash of xi equals y. Okay, so the probability that some number that I choose happens to come out to the right value is 1 over 2 to the 56. Now, let's flip it into what you want, which is, how many x's do I have to do before I find one? Okay? So the probability of x1 coming out to this right value is so small, right? That's really, really small. So it's probably not going to happen for x1. But no problem. I can try x2. I can try x3. I can try x4. If I try 100 x's, am I going to find one that comes out to this particular value? How many x's would I have to try? Okay. So you're going to have to try 2 to the 256. So we're going to flip it. Now I'm going to define this a little more formally, okay? So we'll go through, like, I'll write it out in terms of expected value. But we'll get to that in the notes. But that's essentially where we're headed. Okay? Is that clear to everyone? Okay. So now, if this says we want things, if feasible means 2 to the 112 bits, how long should D be so that our hash function is secure? So it should be 112 bits at least, okay? And if it gets bigger, let's say we use 128 instead of 112, is that getting better or is it getting worse? It's getting better, okay? This probability is going down, which is what we want. The amount of brute force that we have to do is going up, okay? So the bigger D is, the better it is for us, okay? So if we way overshoot and use 256, then that's fine. That's well above 2 to the 112, okay? Now, it turns out that there's a reason we use 256, because collision resistance you can do a lot faster than you can do this, but we'll get there eventually. Okay, so in general, the probability that the hash of some x that I choose at random happens to come out to a given y is going to be 1 over 2 to the d, where 2 to the d is the size 2 to the size of the output of your hash function. Okay, so that's the same as the 2 to the 256 there. And therefore, you get 2 to the d amount of work to break pre-image resistance. Or what we sometimes refer to is, we might say that has 256 bits of security. Okay, so that means it takes 2 to the 256 bits. Or sorry, 2 to the 256 attempts to break it. Just as short firm will say, oh, that's 256 bits of security. Okay. Okay, so NIST says, you know, we want 112 bits. So in this case, we want 2 to the 112 bits. Okay. So we've already switched into lecture 2 about a little bit. We have a little more time. Okay, so this is sort of retreading. So how big does D have to be for it to be pre-image? We'll abbreviate pre-image resistance as PR as well. Another key assumption is this is assuming that there's no other defects in the hash function. So this is the algorithm that always works, right? You can always do exhaustive search. Sometimes you can shortcut exhaustive search. So the reason MD4 and MD5 broke, it's in part because exhaustive search actually became feasible. Okay, their D was too small for collision resistance in order to be not computable. And we'll see why, because collision resistance it takes less time. It needs to be twice as big, essentially, as what you would have to think, what you would think. But there were also shortcuts, okay? So there were some artifacts in the algorithm. This course will not focus at all on the shortcuts, okay? All I'm going to show you is the most naive algorithm, which is exhaustive search. We'll do all our computations based on that algorithm itself. The other is too situational. It depends specifically on what the algorithm is and that type of thing. And for any modern algorithm, or I say, like, this is sort of NIST approved, what that means is there are no real known shortcuts at this point for those algorithms. So that applies to SHA-3 as well, SHA-256. Yeah, so you can think of it as patterns, essentially. So it's basically like looking at the low-level details of how things work and then realizing it's not as random. So this is essentially assuming that it looks random. It turns out it's not exactly random. Yeah. Okay, so assuming no other defects means that we just assume that the output is random, so it's like flipping a bunch of bits. Okay, so we have some hash output, and it's d bits long, okay? And every bit is either a 0 or 1. That's what it means to be d bits. So the probability that the first bit is a 0 is 50%, and the probability that the first bit is 1 is 50% as well. So that means that if I give you an output and I ask you what's the probability that the output you just tried matches the output that I gave you, it's going to be 1 over 2 to the d. Okay, so this is just repeating what we've already said. Okay, so let's say I'll do the slightly more formal analysis of how to do it. So one way that we can break pre-R, pre-image resistance, is to choose inputs until the output happens to match Y, okay? And what we want to know is how many inputs do we have to choose? So we're looking to get this number out, but I'm just going to prove it to you that this is the number that comes out. So since we don't know what the number is because we haven't done our analysis yet, let's just call it something for convenience, okay? So we'll call it capital N. Okay, so capital N is the number of inputs we'll have to try until it happens that the hash comes out with the value that matches the value I gave you. That's a mouthful. Let me say it again. I give you a value. You're going to do a counter. You're going to hash 0. You're going to hash 1. You're going to hash 2. You're going to hash 3. And eventually, you're going to stop at some number N. Okay, and when you hash N, that number will match the value that I gave you. Okay, how big is that number N? How big do you have to count? How many numbers do you have to count to? Do you have to count to a million, a billion? How many numbers do you have to count before you hit one with probability, high probability that it will actually be the right one? Okay, so if we want to formally just define this, we can use expected value. So expected value is the probability of something happening if you try the same thing over and over again. Okay, so basically it takes two values. One is how many times are you trying it, and what's the probability of success on one try, okay? So if you want to flip a coin until you get heads, right, then, you know, if you flip it 10 times, right, that's you're trying it 10 times, and the probability for all of them is a half, okay? So it would be 10 times a half, okay? So that's expected value, okay? So we have some number of chances times the probability that the chance is actually favorable. That's going to tell us how many of these pre-images or inputs we have to try. Okay, so what we can do is we can fill in these numbers. So first off, we want to calculate the expected value when it equals 1. Okay, so we want to make sure n is big enough that on expectation it will happen. Okay, we will see one instance where this is true. Okay, so the expected value will set to 1. Okay, so we want to run n enough that it comes out that our expected value is 1. The number of times we have to run it, we don't know. We're just calling that big N. That's what we want to calculate. And the probability that one input that we try just happens to come out right is going to be 1 over 2 to the D, which is what's on the board. Okay? So we have 1 equals N times 1 over 2 to the D. We can reverse it, and we get N equals 2 to the D, which is what we're expecting. Okay? So what that means is that on the amount of work, so if it's 1 over 2 to the 56, then the expectation is going to be 2 to the 256. Okay, so if the number of hashes we have to try is 2 to the D, and we want it to be infeasible, well, infeasible means that it's greater than 2 to the 112. Okay, so this says you have to do at least 2 to the 112 work. So 2 to the D has to be greater than 2 to the 112, therefore D has to be bigger than 112 bits, okay? So anyway, you can go over this exercise again. It's basically kind of formalizing something that's sort of obvious. I mean, all of you knew sort of what the answer was. Everyone who followed at least what was on the board sort of knew where we were going with this. But the reason that we're taking this exact specific approach is because things won't always be this obvious. So when we start talking about collisions, collisions actually happen a lot easier than finding pre-image resistance. It kind of sounds like you're trying to solve the same problem, but it turns out you're solving a problem that's really a lot easier. It's so much easier that it has a fancy name called the birthday paradox, which I'll explain, and it shows up in all sorts of math problems, okay? But it's called paradox because, you know, you sort of formulate this probability and everyone thinks this probability is really rare, and it turns out it's not actually that rare, okay? And so collisions actually exploit it. And in order to show it, we do have to follow the same math in order for me to really convince you of why it's that particular case. So that's why we're using, anyway, formal math to derive something that seemed intuitive just by working it out on the board. Okay, is there any questions about this? Yeah. Right. So let's back up to this. So the expected value would be, let's say, what's the expected number of heads if I flip a coin 10 times, right? So the expected number of heads would be a half times 10, so I'm flipping it 10 times. And so that would mean it would come out to be 5. Okay, so I would expect 5. Now in this case, our variable is here. This is the number we're interested in computing, and we know these two numbers, right? We know we're flipping it 10 times, and we know the probability is a half, okay? In this case, it's the opposite. The variable is here. We don't know the number of chances, okay? But we do know the probability, and what we're doing is we're fixing the expected value. So if I said, how many times do you have to flip a coin in order to see 5 heads, right? Then you could put 5 in for this value. You could call this n. You could put in a half for this value, and then you could compute what it is, okay? So what are we doing here? What we're doing here is we're asking, what's the number of times before we see 1 pre-image? Does that make sense? Okay, so that's why we put a 1 in here. So we're expecting, we want to calculate how many n to see 1 pre-image. So here's a question, what if we want to find 2 pre-images? So n's going to have to be bigger. So what we'll do is we'll put 2 in here, okay? And then when we rearrange this equation, we're going to get 2 to the d times 2, which is going to be 2 to the d plus 1, okay? So 2 would be 2 to the d plus 1. Okay, any other questions? Okay, I want to be really sure that we get this. So let me explain it one more time slightly differently. So we saw this diagram before. We'll see this. This will be kind of the kinds of diagrams we'll draw a lot. This is the output of a hash, and there's two, let's keep it general in terms of d. So there's 2 of the d values in this particular output. Okay? And what I'm doing in this sort of pre-image resistant experiment is I'm giving you one of these. So I'm saying, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to find some input that maps to that output, okay? That output is one of 2 to the d possible values, okay? And so what the exhaustive search says, let's pick an input, okay? And this input's going to map somewhere into that space, okay? So maybe it maps here. Maybe it maps here. Maybe it maps here. Maybe it actually maps where we want it to map. Okay. So what's the probability that it maps to any one of those outputs? So the first assumption we're making is that this is a random mapping. So what that means is the probability that it maps to any one of these 2 to the d is the same. So it's not any more likely to map here than it is to map here or to map here. Okay. In other words, it's a uniform probability. It says it's equally as likely to map to any of those. Okay? So there's 2 to the d of them, and they're all the same, so what's the probability that it maps to any given one? It's going to be 1 over 2 to the d, right? So what's the probability that it maps to the chosen one? Okay? It's going to be 1 over 2 to the d. Okay? So that's the number that we get. Here, okay, so that's this number, 1 over 2 to the d, which is defined as the probability of one chance being favorable, meaning that it actually comes out to the right value. Okay, so it's 1 over 2 to the d. Now, what we're going to do in exhaustive search is with high probability, it's not going to come out here. It's going to come out somewhere else. What's the probability that it comes out somewhere else? 1 minus 1 over 2 to the d. Okay, so with high probability, it's not going to come over somewhere else. So we're going to try again. Okay, And so this one has a chance of mapping there, but it also has a big chance of mapping here. Okay. And so what's basically, how many of these are we going to have to try until we expect to see one that does come out here? Okay, that's the question that we're trying to ask. Okay, so it's phrased in terms of how many. We don't know how many. We're trying to compute it. We're going to give it a variable. We're going to call it n. Okay? It's how many until something happens. Okay? What is it that's going to happen? Okay? What's going to happen is we're going to expect. See, we don't know when this will come out. We can't put down an exact number because it's based on chance, right? It might happen. You might get lucky and the very first number you try actually comes out to that value, okay? Or it might take a very long time. So we can't talk in terms of it will always take exactly this amount of time. So whenever we can't talk about exactly the amount of time it will take, what we talk about is how long do we expect it to take, okay? So that's expectation. Same thing with flipping coins. How long is it going to take to flip 10 heads? Well, maybe, you know, it takes 10 coins, right? Maybe it takes 20. Maybe you flip 100 times and you still haven't got 10 heads, okay? So all we can say is on expectation, okay? So what's the condition? We want to try n until something happens. Well, until we expect. Okay? Until we expect a match. What do we mean by a match? Well, we really mean one match, okay? That's the key, okay? So a match is the same as saying one match. Okay, and now we have all the pieces of our equation, okay? We have the one, which is the expected value. We expect to see one match. We have the n, which is the number that we're going to try. And we have the probability that that try actually ends up being the right value. We put them in this equation, n times 1 over 2 to the d equals 1. We solve for n, and it tells us that n should be 2 to the d. So how many of these do we have to try? Well, basically, we're going to keep trying these until we end up with 2 to the n. Okay? Let's put it slightly differently. If you try 2 to the n, you can expect to find a collision. A pre-image, okay? If you try that number of inputs, you can expect, on average, that yes, you will find one, okay? You might not find one. You might get unlucky. You might find three, okay? That's the probability of it, okay? But on expectation, you can expect to find one. If you try any less than this, you're not going to find one, okay? You're not going to expect to find one. You'll expect to find 0.999 in one or something like that, okay? If you try more, then that's fine. That just works in your favor, okay? You'll expect one at least, yeah. Sorry. Okay, is everyone comfortable with it? Okay, so we've seen it sort of three different ways, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So if the number of attempts 2 to the d is, there's some size of d where it switches from being feasible to infeasible. Now d in this case means something specific. It's the output of the hash, right? So you're phrasing it in terms of the amount of work, which is 2 to the d, but the only variable in the amount of work is actually the output of the hash. So we could rephrase it in terms of the output of the hash. So in other words, if you have a hash function and it's 80 bits, it's not secure. It's in 100 bits, it's not secure at this level. If it's 112, well, now all of a sudden it's secure. If it's 128, it's secure. If it's 256, it's secure. So that it crosses over that 112 mark, which is somewhat arbitrary. That's just this recommendation. Does that answer your question, or is it slightly different? Okay. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so hopefully most of you get it. If you don't, spend some time going over it and try and really understand what's going on here. The collision resistance, it's not like infinitely more complicated, but there is this extra twist that makes it a little more complicated. So if you don't understand this, you'll have a much harder time following the collision resistance because we have to factor in this birthday paradox feature as well. Okay, so we'll get to the collision resistance next class. There's no more questions, so everyone have a good week, and I'll see you next week.